Let's see. I ended last time by giving you what I think is a really unusual and peculiar explanation for Pade theory and continued fractions. And the way I presented it was in the form of an IQ test. That is, how do you find the next term in a series, in a sequence? Okay. And what I did was to say this. Here is a sequence an. Okay. By the way, we were rushed at the end, so I will just review a few of the things that I said. But here is a sequence a sub n. And I said, let's implicitly, we can assume that a0 is 1. It doesn't make any difference. Okay, and then we have the numbers a1, a2, a3, and so on. And we imagine that that is a sequence that is rather complicated, difficult, in which it's rather difficult to predict what the next number in the sequence is. Okay, and furthermore, the numbers in the sequence are growing rapidly with n. Okay, so typically, the numbers that I gave you, these numbers, 1, 5, 61, and so on, these numbers are growing very rapidly. In fact, they're growing roughly like 2n factorial. Not 2 times n factorial, but 2n all factorial. So it's growing very rapidly. And I said, if you look at these numbers, it's very hard to guess the next number. If I give you an IQ test that says, say to you, what's the next number? Not many people would come up with 1385 right off the bat. It's not obvious. What I said was, we can take this sequence and convert it into another sequence of numbers, bn. And again, without any loss of generality, we can take b0 to be 1. But then we can generate a sequence of numbers, b1, b2, b3. And what I claimed was that if these numbers here grow like, say, 2n factorial, these numbers here will grow roughly like n squared. So it's a sequence of numbers that are much smaller. And maybe where there's a chance, you might be able to guess the next number in the sequence. Now, of course, you can't always look at a sequence and guess the next number. You have to be clever, creative, and lucky. Okay, and one of those might well be missing. But in any case, the key point here was that I was able to transform this sequence into this sequence. Okay. And once we have this sequence and guess the next number in it, of course, we can always transform back. And what I said to you was, there are 3 steps in this transformation, okay? And they're all very, very simple. The first step is to imagine that the numbers a sub n, are the 2nth moments of a weight function. So we imagine there's some function w of x, and that the integral of w of x from some number to some number. We don't know that number, and we don't know that function w. But I asked you to imagine that a sub n is the nth moment, the 2nth moment of the function w. Okay? And of course, the integral of, by assumption, the integral from minus l to l of w dx is assumed to be 1. Okay, that was the assumption we made up here. Okay? And that was all. So all I asked you to do was to imagine something, but not to do anything. Just imagine. Okay? Then the second thing I said to you was, if you had a bunch of numbers b, what could you do with them? Okay, you could write them down on a 3x5 card and send them to the queen. That's one possibility. Okay? But another possibility is to generate a set of polynomials. Okay? So p0 of x is going to define that to be 1. And p1 of x will define that to be x. And then we're going to generate this sequence of polynomials just iteratively, meaning that we'll define the n plus first polynomial as being simply x times the nth polynomial minus bn times the n plus first polynomial. OK, that's just a recursion relation. And given the first two polynomials, you can generate all of them. By the way, the set of polynomials that you will generate this way are called monic. OK. OK. The reason that they're called monic, does anybody know the word monic? Yeah. What does it mean?
Leading one.
That's right. The coefficient of the highest power of x is 1. And you can see that that's obviously going to be true, because the next polynomial is obtained by multiplying the previous polynomial by x. Okay, so the highest power of x will always be 1. It's not really, this is one of these words that you use at a cocktail party to make people think that you're a good mathematician, whether or not you are. You know, it doesn't actually convey a lot of information.
Well, yes.
When you LaTeX something, it comes out faster. You know, M O N I C. It's only 5 words, 5 letters. I mean, it's faster than writing the highest. So you've generated these polynomials, and the first few polynomials that you generate. I'll write them down again because it's fast. Okay, so P2 of x, if you generate it using this recursion relation, is just x times P1, which is x squared, minus B1 times P0, which is 1. So that's the polynomial. Okay, and the polynomial after that, P3 of x, is x times p2, which is x cubed minus b1x, minus b2 times p1. Okay, so minus b2 times x. Okay, and that's the third polynomial. And you can continue this procedure. It's perfectly straightforward. I guess I could compress this a little bit. Okay, and what you see is that the polynomials that you're generating have parity. You notice that the odd polynomials are odd functions of x. Odd-numbered polynomials are odd functions of x. And the even-numbered polynomials are even functions of x. Okay, and you can see that. So that these polynomials respect parity. And that's also the reason why I'm imagining over here that I'm integrating from minus L to L. Okay, so I imagine that this weight function here is an even function, and everything has parity. Okay, so far, this step one is absolutely trivial, and step two is absolutely trivial. Step three was to require that. OK, WRT means with respect to. We demand that the set of polynomials Pn is an orthogonal set of polynomials. Most polynomials, of course, are not orthogonal. There's no reason for polynomials to be orthogonal. And we're going to demand that these polynomials be orthogonal with respect to W. OK, so what that means is that if you take Pn of x, and you multiply that by Pm of x, and you multiply by W of x, which is our weight function, and you integrate from minus L to L, you get 0 if n is not equal to m. So that's what I mean by orthogonality. Okay, and we can simply impose that requirement. Now, someone asked at the end of the lecture, we were moving very fast at the end, but someone asked, wait a minute, isn't this requirement here is, there are many of these equations, right? Because n can take on an arbitrary value, and m can take on an arbitrary value. The only thing that's important is n is not equal to m. So we have lots and lots of conditions of orthogonality. For example, we know automatically, it's obvious, that P2n is orthogonal to P2m plus 1. Okay? This is obviously 0. Okay? Why is that? Because this is an even function of x. This is even. This is an even function of x. This is an odd function of x by construction. And so this is just 0 trivially, just because we're integrating an odd function from minus L to L. Okay, so it's trivially 0. However, there are still lots and lots of conditions. For example, we could require that P0 is orthogonal to P2, and P2 is orthogonal to P4. But also P0 is orthogonal to P4, and P1 is orthogonal to P3, and P1 is orthogonal to P5, and so on. And we have many, many conditions, and they will all be satisfied. Okay, this is not an overdetermined problem at all. In fact, this problem, this set of conditions, most of these conditions are redundant. And these conditions uniquely, uniquely, that's an E, determine the relationship between A, the A's, and the B's, okay? And there's a unique relationship. And what we learned was something like A1 equals B1, and A2 was equal to B1 times B1 plus B2, okay? And A3 turned out to be B1, B2, B3 plus B1 times B2 plus. B1 plus B2 squared, and so on. And these relationships get more and more complicated as you go along, but they're always simple algebraic relationships, always. Okay. And furthermore, you can go from the A's to the B. Given the A's, you can find the B's uniquely. Given the B's, you can find the A's uniquely, and you can see that happening. For example, once you know A1, you know B1. And now that we know B1, if you're given A2, I can find B2 uniquely. Okay? And once I know B1 and B2, I can find B3 uniquely. Okay? It's linear in the next unknown B. Okay? So you proceed down this table and you calculate all the B's. And once you've calculated the B's from the A's, you guess the next B. Okay? And now that you know the next B, you use these formulas to calculate the next A. That's how you, Yeah?
I assume you've tried to generalize these formulas without having to go through all the middle stuff. So
absolutely.
Have you been able to get anywhere?
You mean?
To generalize the
formulas to generate this.
Without doing the middle steps.
You betcha. And I'll show you how to do it.
Okay.
But I thought this was kind of cool. Okay. So let me answer your question. Okay. Suppose, so now I turn on a more stern and mathematical face. Okay. So suppose you had a Taylor series of that form, okay? Suppose you had a Taylor series of that form, okay? And where you're given the coefficients in the Taylor series, and these A's are precisely these A's over here, okay? So same notation, okay? Now, on the other hand, suppose you had a continued fraction. Okay, so what's a continued fraction? It has, you have all studied already continued fractions, right? That's great. So suppose you had the following continued fraction, b0 over 1 minus b1x over 1 minus b2x over 1 minus b3x. Okay, so here is a Taylor series. Here is a continued fraction. Now, to evaluate, I mean, if someone walks up to you on the street and gives you something like this and says, evaluate it, what is it that you actually do? What you do is you first say B0. Okay? First you write down B0. Okay? Which, by the way, we are taking to be 1 for simplicity. Okay? If it isn't 1, you just multiply by an overall factor and make it. So first, you write down B0, okay? Then you write down this. You write down B0 over 1 minus B1x, okay? Then you write down B0 over 1 minus B1x over 1 minus B2x. So what I'm doing is I'm truncating the continued fraction right here. And then the next truncation would be here, and the next truncation would be here, and so on. And you see what I've done? I've constructed a sequence of numbers, okay, which I can evaluate algebraically. This is just, you just do it. Just evaluate these numbers, okay? So I end up with a sequence of continued fractions. And the question is, does this converge to a limit or not? It might converge to a limit. It might not converge to a limit. Okay? But this is how you evaluate a continued fraction. And you hope that it converges to a limit, because if it doesn't, it just bounces around and it's not very meaningful. Okay? In the same sense, if someone walks up to you and gives you this written down on a piece of paper and says, evaluate it, what is it that you do? You form the partial sum, okay, you call this Sn, okay, and you write down the sequence of partial sums. In other words, to evaluate something, you always, always create a sequence and ask whether or not that sequence has a limit. So what you write down is S0, S1, S2, and you ask, does this approach a limit? That's the question. Okay, so you have a sequence of numbers here, and you ask, does it approach a limit? And of course, if this series is divergent, it does not approach a limit. And if it does approach a limit, we say the series is convergent. And over here, you see that this sequence could approach a limit, and it might not approach a limit. Okay. Yeah.
Here, do you give a value to x, or otherwise?
X has some some. In principle, x is some number, okay? But I'm treating x right now as being a variable. Okay, and so x, this sequence here, of course, each term in the sequence is itself a function of x.
Yeah, but then, I mean, this thing is going to get pretty complicated to look at, right? So I figured it might be very hard to see if this converges to something if it's a giant...
It might be very hard. That's right. This is not trivial. Okay, it's very hard. I agree. I mean, this is... And in fact, we're on the edge of what is known about this, in fact, is very, very limited. The most famous book, by the way, if you're interested in continued fractions, the most famous book is a book by Wall. And it has the surprising title, Continued Fractions. Okay, and it's a big, thick book. It has lots and lots of information about continued fractions. And basically, you will learn epsilon of what remains to be learned about continued fractions and their convergence. Okay, it's very non-obvious whether or not this will actually converge to a limit. Not at all obvious. The first thing you might ask, however, is what happens if I take each of these terms in my sequence and expand them into a Taylor series? Okay? So, in other words, if I expand this, this is not a function of x, this is just a constant, this is a function of x, but I could expand this into a Taylor series, and if I do, it would have the form b0 times 1 minus b1 times 1 plus b1 times x plus higher powers of x. Okay, you see that? It's a geometric series. And if I multiply this out, I get b0 plus b0 b1 x. And if, and of course, b0 is taken to be 1. So let me do that right away. b0 is 1. Okay. And if I compare this Taylor series, this is 1. Okay. If I compare the first term in the Taylor series with this, okay, what I learn is that a0 is equal to b0, which is equal to 1. Okay, which we already assumed. But if we look at the next term in the series, this Taylor series has the form, you know, 1 plus a1x plus a2x squared plus and so on, right? And if you look at the coefficient of x in this series, it's right here. So if we compare this series with this series, you get the equation a1 equals b1. Okay? And that's precisely the equation that I wrote down over here. Okay? Let's look at this structure over here and expand this into a Taylor series. So this is a little bit more messy, but we can do that. First of all, let's remember here that b0 is just 1. Okay? Now, if I expand this in a, of course, you know how to expand something in a Taylor series. You differentiate with respect to x and evaluate it at x equals 0. And boy, is that awful and boring. Not going to do that. So what I'm going to do here is first, I'm going to expand this thing in the denominator, which gives me 1 over 1 minus b1x times. And when I expand that in a Taylor series, I get 1 plus b2x. Okay, which I then expand in a series. Again, this is, you can't see that low, probably. Let me put it up here. Okay, if you expand this in a series, you get 1 plus b1x times 1 plus b2x plus the square of this thing, but to order x squared, the square of this is b1 squared x squared. So if I write out these Taylor coefficients, I get 1 plus b1x plus b1 times b1 plus b2 times x squared plus higher powers of x. So to second order in powers of x, you see you get the series 1 plus b1x. That's what we already had in the second term. And then in the third term, you see b1 times b1 plus b2 x squared. Okay? So comparing that with this, I get the equation a2 is b1 times b1 plus b2. So if I require that the Taylor, so let me say this very slowly and emphatically. If I take the Taylor expansion of my continued fraction, so I expand the continued fraction in a Taylor series, and I demand that that Taylor series agree with this Taylor series, what I end up with is this wonderful sequence of algebraic relations between the A's and the B's. Okay. Are there any questions about that? You see what we've done? Yeah. You'll see in a minute. Okay. Why are we doing this? Okay. The answer is, let me give you a quick answer. The answer is because even if the Taylor series does not converge, this sequence of continued fractions typically does converge, and it converges to the right answer. And that's amazing. Okay. Now, the reason, of course, you saw this last time a little bit when I showed you a continued exponential. The continued exponential converged outside of the circle of convergence. Remember the continued exponential, here was the circle of convergence for a Taylor series, and the continued exponential converged in a much bigger region. So if you were at this point over here, and you needed to sum the Taylor series only converges in here. Okay? So you could not sum up the Taylor series for this value of x. But if you first convert that Taylor series to a continued exponential, and then evaluate the continued exponential as an infinite sequence, that sequence converges, and it converges to the right answer. What I mean by the right answer is the answer determined by the analytic continuation of the function defined by the Taylor series inside of the circle of convergence of the Taylor series. Okay? There were a lot of words there. Did you understand that? So this is a very, very powerful technique I'm giving you. Okay? Of course, what we're eventually getting to, and we're almost there now, is that typically this Taylor series never converges. It's not as if it has a little circle of convergence where it does converge. It typically never converges. And typically, this sequence of continued fractions converges for almost all x, which is astonishing. And it converges to the right answer. Yeah?
Can you use this technique of comparing the terms in the Taylor series for any continued function?
Yes, yes, indeed. This is, in fact, how you determine the coefficients in the continued function. So, for example, if instead of a continued fraction, your fancy was a continued logarithm, let's say. Strange idea, but perfectly reasonable. So instead of something like this, you would write down C0 times the log of 1 minus, maybe plus, I don't know, minus x times C1 times the log of 1 minus x times C2 times the log of, and so on. And that would be a continued logarithm. And if you truncate, so how do you evaluate a continued logarithm? It's obvious. You write down a sequence of approximants. These are called approximants. Okay, so the first approximant would be C0. Second approximant would be C0 times the log of 1 minus x C1. Okay, and the next one would be C0 times the log of 1 minus x C1 times the log of 1 minus x C2. And so on. Okay, and the question is, the clear question is, in what region does this sequence of approximants converge? Okay, but before you can even test that, you have to know what these numbers are. So what you do is you truncate this, expand it into a Taylor series, compare the coefficients of the Taylor series of this with the Taylor series that you're beginning with, this Taylor representation of the function, which might not even converge. It may only be a formal Taylor series that has a zero radius of convergence. And you compare powers of x, and from the a's, you determine the c's. And now you ask two questions. Question number one, does this continued logarithm, this sequence of continued logarithms, converge? And the second question is, does it converge to the right answer? Okay, those are two very different and very important questions. Yeah.
How do you define a right answer for a sequence
okay.
that has zero
so answer? We have to answer that. It's clear. Okay. The point here, of course, is remember where all this came from. We are solving a physics problem. And how do we solve a physics problem? We use perturbation theory, okay? And we get the answer. The answer is a series of the form a sub n epsilon to the n, where epsilon is our perturbation parameter. So here I'm just using a generic number x, but typically it's epsilon, okay? And the question is, and of course at the end of the calculation, we are typically going to set epsilon equals 1 to recover the original problem. Remember, we inserted an epsilon, an artificial epsilon. Then we treat it as an analytic parameter, and we determine from this formal Taylor series a sequence, say, of continued fractions. There is a right answer to that physics problem, and presumably there's only one right answer, and we want this sequence to converge and to converge to that right answer. And it's a very deep question whether or not, even if it converges, whether it converges to the right answer. And I'm going to give you, let me tell you how the rest of this course is going to be organized. I want to show you some numerical results once we finish this brief discussion here. I'm going to show you some numerical results and show you that these things really do converge. And I want to show you how they converge. And then in the rest of this course, I want to do two things. One, I would like to answer the theoretical questions about Pade. Okay, what we're constructing, we'll have this in a second, but the theoretical issues of Pade theory, okay, and what is known. I'm going to summarize what is known. And what you're going to see is that what is known is dreadfully little, but I'll tell you everything that is known, okay? And then I also want to talk about Feynman diagrams, because typically we generate formal series of this type. They come from sequences of Feynman diagrams. They don't have to, but they often do. Yeah.
So basically, we start a problem. We have a sequence of an, mm-hmm. and we only have very few terms in our AIs.
Right.
Have 3 or 4 terms.
Right.
And they're
right.
all going to be divergent, or at least they're going to. These look like they're divergent.
No, so no. Wait. What's divergent? The sum of the series is divergent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to use these guys and this technique to find our BIs. And
right.
we can hopefully spot a pattern of BIs and find all of the Bs.
Mm-mm.
And
oh no, that would be close to that would be a miracle of 29th magnitude. Okay, I mean it would be or one minus 29th magnitude. I mean that's not in real life. Okay, so in real life, you work very hard and you find 3 or 4, maybe even 5 terms in this series. And what you want to do is use those 5 terms in the series to get the answer. And what we know is that merely adding up this series is going to be ridiculous. It's going to be it's a divergent series, typically. And it's going to give you an answer like 6 million. And the answer you're looking for is 0.7. Yeah, so, okay. I mean, typically, if the nth term in the series grows like 2n factorial, by the time you get to the fifth term, the coefficient here in the series is, 10 factorial. And the answer you're looking for is 0.7. Okay, so how do we really extract the answer from the first 5 terms in the perturbation series? That's the problem we're facing. Okay? Yeah?
I'm sorry, but I think I may have missed it, but I didn't see why this procedure gives us a sequence of numbers bn, which corresponds with the sequence of continued fractions.
Because it produces exactly the same algebraic mm-hmm. equations that relate the A's and the B's.
This particular sequence it does, but does it produce the same thing for every sequence?
Yeah, the sequence, everything I told you was generic.
Generic.
Yeah, it was completely generic. Okay, it is not, by the way, the reason why I'm showing you this is that there is a very deep connection between orthogonal polynomials and continued fractions. And I showed you that connection through the back door, just by this peculiar illustration of guessing the next term in the sequence. Okay, and what the theory, what the important theory is really about is the fact that if you wish to convert a Taylor series into a continued fraction, okay, you do so by means of these algebraic connections between the coefficients. You get these algebraic connections by expanding the continued fraction into a Taylor series and comparing powers of x term by term. But buried in there, and it's not at all obvious that it's buried in there is all of this theory about orthogonal polynomials, okay, which I think is very interesting. Yeah?
Why is it that it is efficient in writing out a sequence for a continued fraction to expand each approximant to first order?
You don't need to. You can take the nth approximant and simply expand that out in a Taylor series because,
right.
I mean, if you expand the first and take the first, you know, if you expand the first and take the first term and compare the first term, you get one equation. Take the second and expand it into two terms in a Taylor series, you get what you already know and the next new term. So why not just start with the very last term in here, expand it out to n terms in a Taylor series, the nth approximant, expand it to n terms in a Taylor series, and just make the comparison, of course. Okay. Yeah?
So we got the Taylor series, as people said, by doing a perturbation expansion.
Right.
If we believe the answer is a continued fraction, presumably if we were...
No, wait. It doesn't... You can't say... What we're talking about is the notion of representation. It's not the answer is a continued fraction.
Let me revise.
Yeah, do you see what I'm saying?
The answer is clearly not a Taylor series because we can't represent
It the word is representation. The answer exists in an abstract sense and it has a life of its own.
Okay, the answer is clearly not analytic because we can't write it as a Taylor series
right.
that converges.
But, so since this is not a Taylor series, what this really is, so first of all, it is not strictly true that I can write an equal sign there. I have to use an asymptotic symbol, and I have to generalize the notion of Taylor series to the notion of asymptotic series. So this is the asymptotic series representation of the answer. It looks like a Taylor series. It is a formal Taylor series, but it doesn't converge. So it is not a Taylor series. What it is an asymptotic series, and that is the asymptotic series representation of the answer. That's the strict answer to your question. This is the asymptotic series representation of the answer. The answer exists, okay, in an abstract sense, but we don't know how to write it down. We can only write down a representation of that answer. It might be a representation in the form of a Taylor series, if it converges, or an asymptotic series, if that series is divergent, okay, or something else. It might be a Laurent series. It might be an integral representation. There are a million ways of representing the answer. And one very interesting way to represent it is as a continued fraction. And the reason why is that even if the Taylor series is divergent, the continued fraction may well be convergent.
So my question was, we believe the answer can be represented as a continued fraction that
right.
converges somewhere.
Right.
If we were clever enough, presumably, we could have, instead of plugging a power series,
I understand
we could have
your
plugged
question.
In a continued fraction.
Yes,
would
but
we
you
then?
Can't. That's the point. So the procedure is, so we have this flow chart. We begin here with a hard problem, okay? What we do is, we insert an epsilon, and we get a hard problem as a function of epsilon. Okay? We then construct a Taylor series, a formal Taylor series representation of the answer. Okay? And then we can, which is not a convergent series typically. We then convert to a continued fraction, and we sum, we find the limit. And we recover the answer at epsilon equals 1. That's our flowchart. And what your question is, who needs that? Why do we have to go through, or I don't mean that. Who needs this here? why don't we go directly from the hard problem to the continued fraction representation and shortcut it? And the answer is because nobody knows how to do such a thing. Because we had an extremely powerful tool. And the extremely powerful tool was that we were able to compare powers of epsilon.
So that was
okay? That's the tool. So when we were in the midst of our calculations, how did we determine these coefficients A sub n over there, those perturbation coefficients? And the answer is that by comparing powers of epsilon, we were able to reduce our very, very difficult problem to an infinite sequence of easy problems. But we have no such, there's no such procedure that can be used if you simply substitute in the answer in the form of a continued fraction or a continued, some continued function.
So that was sort of the point of the question. Mm-hmm. If the answer has a Taylor series, then we can, the coefficients are unique and we can find the answer by comparing powers.
And if the answer has an asymptotic series, the coefficients are unique.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Okay, so the issue of uniqueness, as you point out, is absolutely essential. And the point is that an asymptotic series has unique coefficients just as a Taylor series. And just the way you can perform operations on a Taylor series term by term, that is, you can multiply two Taylor series together, add them, differentiate them, integrate them, all the usual procedures that you would like to do, they are justified for Taylor series. And that's because the Taylor series is uniformly and absolutely convergent. Now, the asymptotic series is not convergent. Not absolutely convergent, not uniform, not convergent. And it is still justified to operate term by term, and the asymptotic series coefficients are unique. And that's the power of asymptotics. If I were teaching you a whole term instead of just 10 days, I would give you a course. This is what I'm giving you, by the way, is 2 weeks out of a course on asymptotics. Okay, and the rest of it is not here. That's, you have to learn some other place or time or something like that. Okay, but yes, that's the key point, that we can always use term-by-term calculations and term-by-term identification, but we can't do that with continued fractions. Okay, are there other questions? Okay, so here is the last step in this analysis. I want you to observe that this has now become kind of messy, unfortunately. So let me okay. So let me just recap for a second. We have a continued fraction of the form 1 over 1 minus b1x over 1 minus b2x over 1 minus b3x, and so on. And what we said was that the meaning of that continued fraction is that it is a sequence of continued fraction approximants. And what I mean by that is this goes over to 1. That's the first approximant. Second approximant is 1 over 1 minus b1x. The next approximant is 1 over 1 minus b1x over 1 minus b2x. And the next one, we'll write down one more, 1 over 1 minus b1x over 1 minus b2x over 1 minus b3x. Okay? And so on. So this is comma, comma, dot, dot, dot. Okay? Now, the last important structural remark to make here is that let me turn these approximants into rational fractions. So what's a rational fraction?
The quotient of two polynomials.
Exactly. The ratio of the quotient of two polynomials And this is not in that form. Of course, this is in that form, obviously. And this is in that form, but this is not. So let me do something totally trivial here. I'm just going to rationalize this. Okay? So the first term, of course, remains 1. And the second term is 1 over 1 minus b1x. But the third term is not a ratio, obviously, of polynomials. But I can make it that just by multiplying the top and the bottom by 1 minus b2x. So the top becomes 1 minus b2x. And the denominator becomes 1 minus b1x minus b2x. I'm not saying anything deep here. This is all trivia, right? Now, let's look at the next one. And you're going to see the pattern now. In order to make this into a continued fraction, I want you to imagine doing the into a rational fraction. Let's do the following. First of all, let me take this piece here and multiply the top and the bottom by 1 minus b3x. Okay? So that becomes 1 over 1 minus. Now, the top becomes b1x times 1 minus b3x. And the denominator in here becomes 1 minus b3x minus b2x. Okay? Now, it's still not a rational fraction, we have one more multiplication to do. So I'll multiply the top and the bottom by this, which will give me 1 minus b3x over minus b2x over 1 minus b3x minus b2x minus b1x times 1 minus b3x. Okay, now finally, it is in the form of the ratio of two polynomials. Okay, now let's look at the sequence. The first number in the sequence was a polynomial of degree 0. Let's see, maybe you can't see that here. Okay, the first was a polynomial of degree 0 over a polynomial of degree 0, if you like. Okay, it's just 1. Okay. The second one was a polynomial of degree 0 over a polynomial of degree 1. The next one, after we rationalized it, became a polynomial of degree 1 over a polynomial of degree 1. Okay. And the next one, which is what we just worked on, is a polynomial of degree 1 over a polynomial of degree 2. Is that clear? So if we continue this process, it should be kind of evident to you that there is a natural structure here. Okay, degree 0 over degree 0, degree 0 over degree 1, degree 1 over degree 1, degree 1 over degree 2. The next one would be degree 2 over degree 2. Next one would be degree 2 over degree 3. And then degree 3 over degree 3. When I write P2, P2, this is not the same P2. I'm just saying it's degree 2 over degree 2, over degree 2 or degree 2 over degree 3. All of these are different polynomials. Okay? This is called the rational fraction sequence, but it has a name. It's named after a guy whose first name was Henri, and the second name was Padet. And this is called the main sequence of Padet's, okay? And the notation that is often used, not always, but it's often used, is P for Padet, and it's often written NM or something, or maybe MN. I don't know. MN, wasn't that? Okay? So these are Padet's. When you see a Padet, when someone says, I have a Padet here, PMN, what that means, it's a polynomial of degree m divided by a polynomial of degree n. Okay. The main sequence of Padés has the form P00, P01, P11, P12, P22, P23, P33, and so on. This is called the diagonal Padé sequence, or the main sequence, main or diagonal sequence of Padés. Okay? The main sequence or the diagonal sequence. But you don't have to have a member of the diagonal sequence. You could, for example, in general, have P25. That's not, you will never find that if you rationalize approximants in a continued fraction sequence, but P25 is perfectly okay. Okay? Now here's the point. In general, remember I just gave you that flow chart over here, okay, to answer your question, the procedure that we're using as physicists to solve problems. The main point is this. Suppose you have a Taylor series representation of your answer. So here is the answer to your problem as a function of epsilon, and you have a Taylor series representation. That Taylor series might converge and it might not converge. We don't know. But typically, we expect that it will have a zero radius of convergence. And if it does, writing an equal sign there is not correct. So we would replace it by this symbol, which means is asymptotic to, instead of is equal to. Okay? And so we have this representation. What do we do? Well, you truncate the Taylor series. And out of this truncated Taylor series, you can construct any Padé, either a member of the main sequence of Padés or just any old Padé, such as, for example, PMN. Okay, and which is a function of epsilon. Okay, and how do you construct that Padé? That's very, very easy. The coefficients in this Padé are uniquely, that is, of the polynomials in this Padé, they are uniquely determined by the coefficients in that Taylor series if n plus m is equal to n. Okay? And let me show you that there's the right number of pieces of information. There are, in this Taylor series, there are n plus 1 coefficients. Okay? There are n plus 1 pieces of information. And those coefficients are a0, a1, all the way up through an. So there are n plus 1 coefficients. How many coefficients need to be determined here? Well, we have a polynomial. We have a polynomial of degree m divided by a polynomial of degree n. How many coefficients need to be determined in the polynomial of degree m? It's m plus 1, right? There are m plus 1 coefficients here, and there are n plus 1 coefficients here. Oh, whoops. Just a second. It looks like I have m plus n plus 2 pieces of information needed, and my input only has n plus 1.
Assume they're both mod.
No. Well, almost. Not quite. Notice there's a ratio here. Okay. So one of those coefficients is irrelevant because there's a ratio. I can divide it out. In other words, without loss of generality, I could assume this polynomial is monic, as you say. So I don't have to assume that it's the denominator one. But very often what you do is in the denominator, this polynomial has the form x to the n times 1 plus something times x to the n minus 1 and so on. So really, there are only n unknowns here, okay? And so you notice that there are n plus m plus 1 things that need to be determined. And on the left, there are n plus 1 bits of information. So if n is equal to little n plus m, everything works. How do you actually do it? Well, there are two ways to do it. I mean, how do you actually find these coefficients in the polynomial? It's very, very easy. All you do is you say, is you write down the equation, blah, 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 is equal to p sub m of x over q sub n of x, where q is monic. You multiply this of epsilon, okay? You multiply through. So you simply take q sub n of x, you multiply it through here, and you simply compare the powers of x all the way from 0 to capital N, term by term in powers of x, or powers of epsilon, and you get those algebraic equations, and you're done. There's another way to do it that's even faster. You get onto Maxima, or Mathematica, or Maple, or whatever, and you type the word PADE. And it's all programmed. And out pops up. So you give it a Taylor series. You say PADE, the Taylor, construct the MN PADE from this Taylor series, and you're done. That's it. Done. OK? And out pops the PADE. Very simple. So before we quit, I have to answer. Somebody asked me, I forgot who asked me, but somebody asked me why. Or you asked me, why do we do this? So now I'm going to show you. Okay? So I'm going to show you how well you asked me. Don't hide. That's the crucial question. Why does it work? Okay, so let's see if we can. Okay? Let's see. Can we? Oh, it has to warm up?
No, it just doesn't warm up. So warm it up.
It's
faster.
Oh, good. Okay. All right, great. Okay, so let me. Where's that? Ah, here it is. How do we attack this problem? Let's see. All right, so you remember how I began this course. So I began the course by writing down, quote, a hard problem. Okay? And I showed you three possible ways to solve the problem. Now, let's see. It's not actually in the right order, but this is great. The simple way, the straightforward, the very first thing I showed you in this course was, I said, insert an epsilon over here. Okay? And we expanded it out into a series. And you remember the coefficients in the series were 1, and then minus a fifth, minus a 25th, minus 1/25. The fourth term is actually 0. It's missing here. And then here's the fifth term and the sixth term and so on. The radius of convergence is 1.64. Okay, that's the radius of convergence of this series, 1.65. Okay. And if you simply evaluate the series at x equals 1, at epsilon equals 1, okay, just plug in epsilon equals 1, in this series at the end, this is a convergent series. You plug in the answer, and the number you get is 0.75434. And this answer, just from these six terms, is 0.07% off. So you do that, and you are a very, very happy puppy. OK? That's great. However, This is not normally what you would do in quantum field theory. This is a strong coupling expansion, and it's very, very difficult to work out the coefficients in a strong coupling expansion. Normally, what you do is a weak coupling expansion. So let me go up. Can we go up? Yeah. So normally, what you do is you put an epsilon in front of the highest power, not the lowest power. And this is a singular perturbation expansion, typically, in a quantum field theory. And it is here, too. So you notice that instead of the coefficients being very small numbers, like 1/25th, 1 over 125, 21 over 15,600, okay, these numbers, these coefficients in the expansion, are getting very, very big, just like the coefficients in a Feynman diagram expansion. So if at the end of calculating six terms, there's a six, but it's off the screen. Here's the epsilon, and then the power six is off the screen. Okay, if you were to plug in epsilon equals one at the end, the radius of convergence is 0.08. And if you just plug in x equals one, you get 21,476. It's terrible. However, if you convert this expansion now into a 3-3 Padé, right? We have 6, we go out to epsilon to the 6. We can convert this to a 3-3 Padé. What do you get with a 3-3 Padé? 0.76369. And now, instead of 21,000, the answer comes out to be 0.76. And this Padé has an error of 1.2%. And that's really good. Okay, not great, not as good as here, where the error was 0.07%. But it's great. And furthermore, the Padés, if you calculate more and more terms in this series, you are rewarded. The Padés get closer and closer and closer, and they converge to the answer, and this error goes down, down, down. Yeah?
Padé, you want 3-3 or 2-4?
A very, very good question. Normally, what you use is the main sequence of Padés, because it's easier to prove things about them and prove properties of their convergence. However, you know that if you were doing a Feynman diagram calculation, and you only calculated four terms, let's say, in your perturbation series, you'd calculate every Padé in the Padé table. You'd calculate P13, P22, P40, P04, P everything. Okay, and you'd look at the table, and you'd see which numbers, you'd do a little bit of numerology, and you say which seems to be the smoothest, best numbers in this table. Remember, you have no idea what the correct number is. And so you look at this Padé table and you try to extract the answer from this table. Okay, it's experimental mathematics. And then when you finally sucked out every bit of information you can, then you go back to work and calculate one more term in the Feynman diagram sequence. Okay. Yeah?
Would all those numbers in the Padé table be like similar?
Close? Yeah. No. Some of them may differ pretty far. But typically in the Padé table, as you go, so you know, what I mean by Padé table is you have entries, this is N and this is M, let's say. And you have, this is P00, and here's, the increasing Padés, P, and so on. And this is the diagonal sequence of Padés. Okay. Typically, in your Padé table, this sequence usually, not always, but usually converges fastest. But typically, all the sequences of Padés converge to the same answer when things are working well. Okay, and they all converge at different rates, but they all converge to the correct answer. Okay. Choosing a Padé involves a certain amount of art, and we'll try to talk about that. Okay, but do you remember that as a kind of afterthought, I showed you something else at the end? Do you remember that I said another thing we could do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, remember another thing I said we might be able to do is to put a small parameter up in the exponent. Do you remember I showed you that? This is a very strange, I called it delta here instead of epsilon, but never mind, it doesn't matter. And you could expand the answer as a series in powers of delta. And what I did here was to write down the coefficients in that series. Okay, and they involve log of 2 and things like that. Okay? Now, of course, at the end of the calculation, we have to set delta equal to 4 to recover the original problem. Right? You remember that? Okay? If you simply plug plug delta equals 4 into the series, you get garbage, because 4 is such a big number. But if you calculate the 3-3 pade, you get this number, and now the error is even smaller. This is apparently the best perturbation series, okay, which is sort of my favorite perturbation series. And to show you that the series is really, the pade series, pade sequence is really, really converging well, if you calculate the 6-6 pade instead of the 3-3, that means you have to go all the way out to delta to the 12th power to calculate the 6-6 pade. Now the error in your answer is 0.00015%. So this is really, really accurate. Okay, and we have a rapidly converging pade sequence. Okay, yeah.
In quantum field language, what would this expansion correspond to?
Oh, instead of epsilon here is g, the coupling constant, and so what we do is a pade in the variable g, instead of epsilon. Okay, so for example, if we calculated, you know, out to 2 loops, we could construct a 1-1 pade. That's it. Not very much. But the 1-1 pade would be a much better approximation to the answer than just writing down the perturbation series and just leaving it as a polynomial in powers of the coupling constant. Okay. Okay, so now what I wanted to do, yeah?
Can you do delta perturbation theory for quantum field theory?
Yes, you can. And I've written lots of papers on it. And I could give you a whole course on what happens. It's fascinating. But I won't tell you here. But I'll tell you about it afterward or anytime you like. It is a very, very powerful technique. And actually, to answer a question that you asked me outside of class, it requires that you continue off the integers. This is one of the problems where you have to develop a technique for continuing off the integers. Okay, and there's lots of, well, I'll tell you about it. Anyway, that's a very interesting question, and yes, you can. And you can find the appropriate kinds of Feynman diagrams that are used. Yeah?
Are there other sequences for different continued functions that are also well studied and programmed?
Nowhere near as well studied. I mean, I played around with continued exponentials a little bit. Nobody has done a comprehensive study of continued functions that I know of, anyway, and with comparisons between which continued function is best. Different continued functions converge in different regions. This is a pretty much a wide open, it's not completely wide open because a lot of work has been done, but it is kind of a wide open area for study, and it would be very interesting to do a comprehensive comparison between various continued functions and so on. There's lots and lots of research to be done.
So is this because this one's the simplest one, or because there's a reason to believe it's the best?
Well, it's because for this particular one, we can get a partial handle on it. The key contributor here is Stiltjes, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to spend one whole lecture summarizing the theory of convergence of pades. And that theory is pretty well known for a limited sequence of functions, which happen to be called still cheese functions. Okay. However, other continued functions have not been studied seriously, and the convergence theory has not been worked out, and this is a very, very rich area for mathematical analysis and mathematical physics and so on. It's very urgently needed. You understand why it's so urgently needed, because it justifies the use of perturbation theory. It's what's behind the use of perturbation theory. If you can't do PAD A, doing perturbation theory is ridiculous. You know, this perturbation theory here, for example, is ridiculous. It gives you a stupid answer until you PAD A it, and then you get a fabulous answer. That justified the use of the so the radius of convergence, just so you understand, the radius of convergence of this series here is 1, just 1. So if we plug in 4, it's a disaster, okay? It's way outside the radius of convergence. But the PAD A works beautifully. Okay, so now, let's see. So what I want to show you before we quit, and in fact, I probably won't get done showing you, I have about 8 transparencies, and maybe I'll show you 3 of them before we quit. But, and I hope, I don't know if you can see some of these numbers super well, but first of all, what I want to do is to apply PAD A to a Taylor series that has an infinite radius of convergence. Why would you do that, you say? That's stupid. If the Taylor series converges everywhere for all x, why do you need a PAD A? Okay, so what Taylor series am I using? I'm using the Taylor series for the function e to the x, which converges for all x, all finite x. Okay, so why use PAD A? Well, so here are the so what I'm doing is I'm plugging in x equals 1. If I plug in x equals 1 to e to the x, I should be able to calculate the number e. E to the 1 is e. Okay. And here are the Taylor series approximants, and you can see them converging to e, 2.71828, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Here are the PAD A's constructed from that Taylor series, and they're also converging to 2.71828. It's hard to see the difference here, so here is a table of the errors. Okay, and you can see that the PAD A sequence, the errors in the PAD A sequence, are significantly, I don't think significantly is the right word, but are quite a bit smaller than the errors in the Taylor series. So the point is, you should never add up a Taylor series, even a rapidly convergent Taylor series like the Taylor series for e to the x. But first, you PAD A it. Okay, so you convert it into a PAD A sequence, and you notice that the Taylor series, for example, for 20 terms, the 20-term Taylor series, the error in the 20-term Taylor series just added up directly is 10 to the minus 21, which is terrific. I mean, yeah. But the PAD A, the error is 10 to the minus 25. 4 more decimal places just from converting that Taylor series into a PAD A. So that's pretty impressive. So the PAD A is a better way to represent the Taylor series, even if it has an infinite radius of convergence. Okay. Now, let's look at this. Okay. Here, I'm plugging in x is 5. So the answer is e to the 5. Okay. And you notice that a 26-term Taylor series has an error of 10 to the minus 12 in it. And of course, it's going to converge to the exact answer, e to the 5. Okay? The PAD A constructed from that Taylor series has an error of 10 to the minus 17. So it's better. Is it best? I don't know. And the answer to whose question? Your question. You know, is this the best technique? I don't know. This is a question in information theory. What is the optimal continued function And how do you determine the optimal function to continue? In other words, when we convert the Taylor series into a continued, what's the best one to use? I don't know. I don't know. But PaDe works better. And it would be interesting to know whether a continued exponential works even better or worse, or I don't know. What about a continued square root and why? Okay. Now, here is, just going to show you one or two more, because I think this is very important. This is the Taylor series for the function log of 1 plus z over z. Now, 1 plus z over z, the Taylor series for this function, what is the radius of convergence of that Taylor series? 1. And that's because there's a branch cut starting at the point minus 1. So a Taylor series about 0 converges in a circle of radius 1. So let me just draw the picture, and then we quit. OK. So here is the complex plane. This is the this is the circle of convergence. There is a singularity at the point minus 1, which is a branch cut of the logarithm. And that's it. By the way, it looks like there might be a singularity at z equals 0, because this is log of 1 plus z over z. But you know that function is not singular at 0, because log of 1 is also vanishing. So it's 0 over 0, which is regular. OK, now, what I'm going to do is really interesting. I'm going to evaluate the Taylor series for this function at 1 half, which is inside the circle of convergence, and at 1, which is on the circle of convergence, and at 2, which is way outside the circle of convergence. Of course, we know what the answer should be. If I evaluate this function at 2, I should get log of 3 divided by 2. So we know what the answer is. Okay. Now, if I calculate the Taylor series, I'll get a pretty good answer. But if I calculate the PaDes, it always works. But the PaDes always converge at 1 or 2 or 3 or even a million. It doesn't matter. The PaDes are converging. And what you see here is the NN. This is a table of the NN PaDes in the main sequence and the NN plus 1 PaDes. And I want you to notice how these PaDes are converging. Do you notice 0.7, 0.6933, 0.6931? You notice that this is monotone downward. You notice all of these PaDes are monotone decreasing. All of these PaDes are monotone increasing. Do you see that? Every one of these numbers is getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, bigger and bigger. These numbers are getting smaller, and the correct answer is trapped in between. So the PaDes give you, even though they haven't yet converged exactly to the answer, they give you an upper and lower bound to the answer. You remember I told you that the theory of Stieltjes functions is known. This is an example of a Stieltjes function, this function right here. That guy is a Stieltjes function. And for Stieltjes functions, what you know is that the main sequence of PaDes have a remarkable convergence property. The PNNs converge in a monotone decreasing fashion and converge to a limit. The PNN plus 1s converge upward, trapping the correct answer between them. Of course, do you stop at making this PaDe table? This is just the PaDe table of the main sequence. No, of course, you can average the top and the bottom and get even closer. Okay. Furthermore, since it's a monotone sequence, what would you do to this table? Richardson, exactly. So you can Richardson the PaDes and get an even more accurate answer. Okay. Final statement before we quit. For which x do the PaDes actually converge? So you remember I said to you that the Taylor series converges in this circle. in what region of the complex plane, that is, for which complex x, do the pod A's converge? The answer, they converge in the entire complex plane for all complex x, except for those x on this branch cut here. That's where the pod A's converge. So the Taylor series converges in a circle, but the pod A sequence converges for all complex x except the x on the negative real axis. And that is incredible. Yeah, it doesn't matter. If you could be arbitrarily close to that branch cut, but if you're not on the branch cut on the negative real axis, the pod A's converge, okay? They converge to the exact answer. They converge to the exact answer, which in this case, as our illustrative test function, they converge to log of 1 plus z over z. It doesn't matter what your complex value of z is anywhere in the complex plane except on the negative axis, negative real axis. Okay? And that'll give you a feeling of how powerful you are. So if you have, now this is for a Stieltjes function, if you have a Stieltjes function, the pod A's are rigorously known to converge. By the way, in quantum mechanics, do you remember we were calculating the energy eigenvalue? That happens to be a Stieltjes function, and we're going to prove that. or we'll summarize the proof of it. I don't know if we'll give a complete proof. And that's the reason why I'm teaching you this. This is the justification for using pod A's in quantum theory. Yeah?
What is a Stieltjes function?
I'm going to tell you next time. Okay, that's part of the theory. I've used the word Stieltjes function, but that takes some preparation. So. Okay, but you see, this gives you a feeling of the nature of the convergence of the pod A's. This is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. Okay. Stieltjes ghost function.
These are functions whose polynomials are all.